From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think for a moment of what you know about bail used in the justice system. Someone's accused of a crime, so they go before a judge who has to decide whether to release them before their trial or keep them locked up. That's bail. It's a decision usually takes maybe 5 minutes, but the legal scholar Shima Baradar on Boffman says those 5 minutes tell an important story about criminal justice in this system. She says it's a story about poverty and inequality and haste. And here's the thing. Nearly two-thirds of Americans in jail haven't been convicted of anything. Not yet, anyway. Today in the program, Professor Boffman is joining us to make her case for why bail in America is unfair, probably unconstitutional, and needs to be fixed. Join us after the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and we have a new short film on our website I wanted to tell you about. This one is about Maggie Schmidt. She's a young woman from Salt Lake City who has found her place in Deer Lodge, Montana. She runs a ranch up there. And this time of year, Maggie has her hands full because it's calving season. Go see it at RadioWest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The idea of making bail if you're accused of a crime goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. The traditional idea was that you pledged something, like money or property, as a guarantee that you would show up for your trial. And bail was seen as a right, that unless you committed some capital crime, you had a right to be released until the trial. And along with that came this presumption of innocence. But compare that with the way bail works today in America's criminal justice system. The legal scholar Shima Baradar on Boffman says in a new book that bail is often only available to people with money or influence. She argues it's unfair, it's racist, and it has costs to the system like extraordinary mass incarceration, but also individual costs to people's personal lives. Professor Boffman says it didn't used to be this way, but over time, the system has evolved into one, she says, where judges are allowed to predict which defendants are guilty or dangerous, and the presumption of innocence has become distorted. Today in the program, we're talking about bail in America's criminal justice system and the ideas to reform it or return it to its original intent. The book is called The Bail Book, A Comprehensive Look at Bail in America's Criminal Justice System. Shima Baradar on Boffman is a professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. Her work focuses on criminal law and procedure and international law. And she's joining us here in the studio. And welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
When did you start thinking about bail? When did this become a focus for your work?
So I didn't hear about bail at all in law school, but my first year out of law school, I clerked for a judge. And one of the big opinions in the Ninth Circuit was what the rights of people on bail were, basically pretrial detainees, right? They weren't convicted of anything. They were charged with something. But what are their rights? I mean, were they akin to people on parole?
Yeah.
Or were they akin to people that were just on the street?
Yeah, they're like in a limbo. Where do they fit?
Exactly. And so that was a big debate, and it got me thinking about it. And then I spent a few years in Africa doing a Fulbright and studying pretrial detention specifically in Malawi. And that really got me thinking more about how we can deal with it in the U.S. And when I came back, that's been my primary focus in teaching law.
Did it surprise you where the United States fits in all of this? Because it seems like, I mean, one of the things you mentioned in the book is that we are only one of two countries in the world that require people to pay money to be released.
Right. It was shocking. And initially, it's funny because when I started looking at bail, I thought, well, surely in Africa, it's just terrible there, right? Everything's hard in Africa. They don't have resources and judges, and they don't. But in a lot of ways, they deal with bail in a lot more constitutional way, at least the way we've interpreted our constitution, and the British government has too. And so in a lot of ways, we are far behind in that realm. You know, the U.S. and the Philippines were the only countries that require money to be released. And it's you know, unheard of in the rest of the world.
When did we start requiring money? At what point did that happen? I mean, we'll dig into the history of this as we go, but just sure. while you mention it, when did we and why did we start requiring money?
So it's interesting because money has been an integral role in all of it at first, but it was really like your family would put up a few hundred dollars and they would get it back when you showed up. It was kind of like a security deposit, which seemed to make sense.
They wanted to make sure you showed up for trial.
Right. Yeah. And that's a really important thing. And that was the basis for bail is, you know, you pay money. If you return to your court date, then you get your money back. That was how it was done. But in the 1890s, actually, an interesting story of how it started is there was a couple bartenders who had a lot of lawyers show up in their bar in San Francisco, the Peter McDonough and his brother. And the lawyers were just always complaining, oh, we don't have enough sureties for our clients. We don't have people to show up to pay money to get our clients out. And they said, well, we'll do it. We'll show up and pay money. And they did it for a small fee, right? Instead of kind of a mom or dad showing up, paying money, getting it back.
Like good entrepreneurs.
Right, like
they
good
saw
entrepreneurs.
An opportunity, right?
And,
yeah.
You know, eventually they shut the bar down because the bail was so lucrative.
Right.
And then it just, you know, skyrocketed nationally until, you know, the 1940s and 50s, it became regular course of business. And by the 1990s, you know, 50% of people released were released on bail. And now it's about 70% of people. So it's even in the last, you know, 30 years, it's grown substantially as far as this commercial bail.
How many people, if we know this, how many people who are incarcerated right now were not convicted, that they're in that limbo stage? Do we know how many of those people are in that?
Yes, these pretrial detainees, we do. So, you know, 2.3 million in prison, right? And then of that, about 600 to 700,000 are in jail. And of that 700,000, about 60 to 70% are in limbo. So you think of all the people in jail in America, 70% of those are non-convicted people. The other third are serving for some kind of, you know, misdemeanor or minor crime. That's the people in jail. So a large percentage of our jail population is pretrial detainees. And that's really where our problems are. You think of the California overcrowding that we always hear about and other states. Utah, it's one of those issues. We always have jail overcrowding. Why? Because of pretrial detainees, because of the bail issue.
So we'll dig into the legal stuff. But one of the things I wanted to mention, because you do in the book, and there are these scenarios that you lay out at first, and you talk about the individual costs. So would you just talk a little bit about some of the stories that help us explain the difference? Because you have six scenarios that you lay out at first. Three of the scenarios are people who are well-connected, wealthy. They've got the money for the bail. But it's the other three I'm interested in, just as an example, as a kind of a contrast. Now, you don't need to mention all three, but just talk about some of them. There's James, there's Kenny, there's a homeless man named Leslie
that you
mentioned too. Just mention where they fit as a contrast.
Sure. I mean, they're just some small examples of how this happens in everyday courtrooms all across the country. But James, we have a teen. He steals a bus pass. His bail is set at $1,500 for stealing a bus pass. He can't afford it. Ends up staying in jail. You know, you have Kenny. He receives stolen property. She actually receives stolen property. It's a woman.
Okay.
$150 bail suggested by the prosecutor. The judge says, no, that's not enough. Sets $300. He spends 5 days in jail. And, you know, Leslie, that's one of the sadder stories. It's a homeless person living out of his car, is really cold one night, goes into kind of a Walmart, takes four blankets, and is charged with the theft. $3,500 bail set for him.
Who has nothing.
Who has nothing. And so he doesn't have, you know, the money to pay a bail bondsman. He ends up going to jail. There's other people, you know, I mentioned in the book that are charged with crimes. You know, one of them is charged with, some kind of misconduct with police. And he, you know, claims his innocence. He says the police officer targeted him. And he spends, you know, 60 days in jail because he won't take the plea offer. And the plea offer would have gotten him out in a couple of days. And so there's lots of instances like this where people are, you know, given these high bails, they can't afford it. And that's really a shame.
One of the things you write about is that in some ways, this is the most important criminal justice decision made along the way, that the implication for the fate of a defendant is sometimes settled, or at least their trajectory is set in those early days at that bail moment.
Absolutely. And if you talk to most defense attorneys, they will admit that the most important thing is if they can get their client out on bail. I mean, that is the determining factor
on
whether...
That's before you even deal with evidence or any of that other stuff. It's that first, like, as you say, that 5-minute decision.
or 2 minutes. There's a reason. I mean, sometimes two, sometimes five, at most five. And usually you don't even have counsel there. So more than half of people appearing to get their bail set don't even have a lawyer with them. The judge and the prosecutor kind of work it out. And this is the most important decision. It really is. And you think of today with 95% of cases decided by a plea agreement, the bail decision is really the most important one. It's not trial anymore because no one goes to trial.
Yeah. You say if they are detained before trial, that is, they don't make bail, they're more likely to be convicted?
Right.
Why?
So they're three times more likely to be convicted. They have three times longer sentences. Everything goes worse for them. They're more likely to plead guilty if they're innocent. For so many reasons, once they appear at the preliminary hearing, for instance, if you show up in a suit, you've been keeping your job, you're with your family, the judge is more likely to say, look, let's either dismiss or let's work this out. If you're in jail, you show up in your handcuffs and you're scruffy, and the judge is kind of like, well, it's almost status quo rules with these criminal defendants. And if you're out and you've proven, look, he's kept his job, she's, you know, kept her child support payments, I mean, you're just in a better spot throughout the whole system. And you're a better spot with plea negotiations because you have the prosecutor who has ultimate leverage if you're in jail, right? Prosecutors like, what's your leverage, really?
Because you want to get out.
Yeah, and you talk to prosecutors, and they do. They prefer it when the defendant's in jail because they don't have a lot of bargaining power.
So it's a cycle.
Oh, absolutely. Detention begets more detention, right? It's kind of builds on itself.
Bail is supposed to be, as we said, this incentive for you showing up for trial. And you write in the book that it was not intended to prevent a defendant from committing additional crimes or punishment. But that is the way we think about it now.
Yeah.
Like that the judge, they're granting bail because we got to keep this person off the street but that's not the way it was originally intended.
That's not. And it's funny because you read the old Supreme Court cases because our notion of bail is exactly that. And we're often upset if someone's out on bail and commits a crime. You're like, what? You know, how dare you? Who let them out? Which judge was it? And judges are so afraid of that. But initially, I mean, there was just such a different culture. If you, in the book, I talk about how initially when somebody was charged with a crime and arrested, they would make sure not to even arrest them at work or in public. So you think of today's perp walk, right? Mm. Everyone that's arrested, that's a public figure, you have cameras on them, right? You see them getting handcuffed, taken to court. You're following all of this.
Which already biases the process, right?
Absolutely.
But they didn't used to be that way. The idea of protecting someone's innocence to go through this fair process seemed really important.
It was really important. And you think even in the days when they used to have capital offense, you know, people would die for murder or manslaughter all the time. They still had this idea of, look, when you're arrested, before the jury of your peers has convicted you, you have this presumption of innocence. And that was protected at all costs until that trial period was done. And now we have this idea that judges, and so this actually really happened in the 80s, where judges gained this role.
1980s.
In the 1980s, where they gained this role of being able to say, look, we can detain you because you're dangerous.
Yeah.
And before that, I mean, there's an interesting case I talk about in the book, in the 1950s, where there's supposed communists. And you think of 1950s, right? McCarthyism is strong and people are so afraid of communism. And these communists show up and the Supreme Court ends up saying, you know, you can't set a high bail because you think they're communists and they're plotting against the U.S. government, because that just wasn't allowed. You can't do that based on their dangerousness or anything. It's you just have to set a reasonable bail and we'll figure out their guilt at trial, which you think compared to today, right?
Yeah.
Terrorism and the threats that we face, it is completely different the way they thought about it.
So we'll talk about your book actually kind of works through how we got to that point. But let's back up a little bit because I want to ask a little bit more about history. Because you say in the book, from medieval times to modern days, this has been a mainstay. Mm-hmm. Where did it come from, this idea of bail? I mean, you say it's even has roots in the Magna Carta. I mean, it goes way back.
Yeah. And the Magna Carta roots are this kind of idea of, you know, you shouldn't punish someone before
the process,
yeah. Right? And that's where the due process clause even came from. It starts with Magna Carta, then you get the due process clause, and the presumption of innocence was really hand in hand with that. It's no punishment. And nowadays, you know, the courts have wriggled around it, but it used to be that, of course, being in jail is punishment. And now we don't see it that way. But, I mean, in those days, it was, yeah, you're being punished if you're put in jail. So you shouldn't be put in jail unless, you know, you're being served with a capital offense.
Yeah.
And if your life is on the line, everyone's going to run. That was their thought.
Let's talk about where it fits constitutionally. You mentioned the Supreme Court up until the 50s, which is pretty intense a time, and they were still protecting the rights of accused communists. But you say it's grounded in the rights of liberty and due process. So talk a little bit about that. Essentially what you're saying is the way we treat bail now is technically unconstitutional?
I would say so. I think it is, because if you think about what the Stack is, the case I was talking about with the communists, is still good law. And it really emphasizes, if you read that opinion, it says, you know, no one should be presumed guilty. There should be no punishment before trial. Everyone has this presumption of guilt until the process has been established. And now, you know, after Salerno, so Salerno is the 1984 opinion that talks about that you can consider dangerousness, but it didn't overrule Stack. And so the way we've kind of dealt with those two opinions, we said, well, now you can consider dangerousness. So we have risk assessments. We have all these considerations of you know, someone's dangerousness, which we've all kind of come to accept. But I think if you really kind of study the whole history and you look at the last, you know, 200 years, it would seem unconstitutional to me.
Are there efforts now? One of the things you talk about is that for decades, scholars didn't really think about this. Advocates didn't really think about this. No one really questioned all of this. Is that trend reversing? Are you seeing that?
Absolutely. I think in the last, say, you know, 8 years or so, you know, there is so much momentum on this. Lots of scholars are writing about it. Lots of people, lots of, you know, the Prison Policy Institute, the Equal Justice for Law. There's lots of different nonprofits that have come out and realized this is a really key issue. This is what is leading our jail, you know, overcrowding rates. It's contributing to mass incarceration. I think people are starting to realize this is a bigger issue, because you think about it, it's not that sexy of an issue. You think, yeah, there's a lot more sexy things. Bail seems so small and insignificant. But when you really think about it and you talk to people in the system, it is one of the most important things.
Is it partisan? Because I'm thinking Rand Paul is one of the he's, of course, very conservative, libertarian in his, right, I guess, political disposition. But so I guess that makes sense that he very much is trying to reform the idea of bail in this country.
Yes. It's actually as much a left issue as a right issue. It's something that most everyone agrees that looks into the system. So, you know, Rand Paul is proposing a bill with Kamala Harris, yeah, on, you know, two people on different sides of the aisle. And there's a lot of consensus on this. I think in our state, there's consensus on bail reform. I think it seems like it's not a partisan issue. It's kind of, it's costing money, so conservatives can get behind that, right? Mm-hmm. It's a infringement on liberties, which conservatives can get behind. And liberals feel like, you know, defendants are being treated unfairly. It's unconstitutional. And so, you know, whatever your reason for it, you think that the system needs to be reformed.
Shima Bharatharan-Baffman is with us. She's the author of the book, The Bail Book. It's a comprehensive look at bail in America's criminal justice system. We'll take a break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about making bail. If you're accused of a crime in this country, you have an opportunity for bail. It's being released until your trial. But the U.S. is only one of two countries that requires people to pay to make bail and not get that money back. The legal scholar Shima Bharatharan-Baffman says bail has become unfair, unconstitutional, and it's become what she calls an oppressive tool against minorities and the poor. She has a book where she writes about how you can reform the system. It's called The Bail Book, and she's joining us today to talk about it. Okay, so let's talk about the shift. You were mentioning how for a while in this country, we absolutely protected, the courts anyway, the right for bail. But things start to shift. And one of the things you write about is in the 1940s, you say that changes to laws in the 1940s, I think it was, started to alter the bail landscape in the country. Talk about that. What happened What's starting to happen?
Yeah. So what we have before the 1940s is we have a strict policy of the only reason that you would ever detain somebody before trial is if they're not going to appear. So you're worried about flight risk, right? Yeah. This flight risk is the only reason you can detain someone. And in the 1940s, we see a federal law. And then, you know, in the 60s, it's cemented and then it gets worse later. But what happens is there's a federal law that talks about not flight risk, but kind of the nature of the crime that you're charged with. And it's kind of like, you know, why does that matter, right?
Could you think about that before? Could you think about the nature of the crime?
Only if it was a capital offense.
Right.
Right? Okay. Only if it was a capital offense. And now it's, let's think about the nature of the crime. And then in the 60s, you have a law that says you can consider the weight of the evidence against the individual.
And that's like the slippery slope, right?
That's once the slippery slope. Yeah. And you think of the weight of the evidence. I mean, who does weighing of the evidence? That's the jury's role. That's at trial, after the evidence, after lawyers are there. And so who's weighing the evidence? It's the judge and the prosecutor at the bail hearing. There's no defense counsel.
That two-minute bail hearing.
Two-minute bail hearing, and you're weighing the evidence. So, I mean, what kind of due process is that? And that's where I think it really went wrong.
In the 80s, it seemed to there was this Bail Reform Act. Was this in the 80s?
84, yeah.
84. Mm-hmm. So what's significant about that?
Yeah, so the Bail Act. So we have the 66 Act and then we have the 80s. And what happens in the 80s is that the laws change such that they now allow kind of consideration of dangerousness. If they're not safe to release, then we're also allowed to hold them. And that's where Salerno comes up and, you know, considers this. And once Salerno's decided, they, you know, pass this bill, the Bail Reform Act. And that allows explicitly that you can consider whether a person's dangerous to be released or not.
So if a judge can now at this point, starting in these reform movements in the 60s and 70s and 80s, if they could conclude that a defendant in front of them in this bail hearing is possibly likely to be found guilty, what happens to the presumption of innocence?
Right. And that's the thing is, if that's one of the factors they're explicitly allowed to consider, the weight of the evidence, like they look guilty or, you know, they're not safe to release, then they're allowed to detain those individuals rather than before where they had to release them unless there was evidence that they were not going to appear, that they were flight risk.
Yeah.
And in those old days, it used to be they'd look at, you know, do they have a passport and they could maybe take that away or do they have foreign ties, that kind of thing. That was the only consideration you're allowed to do. Whereas now it's, well, what is this case? You know, where, you know, did he get caught red-handed? Did she have certain evidence? You know, that's what they're doing instead of the kind of simple, are they going to appear for their court date?
But how much information do they have at that 2-minute, 5-minute bail hearing? I mean, that's one of the points you make is they don't have all the facts in front of them to really make a proper adjudication.
Right. And you're thinking the 1940s, they didn't have facts. And even today, they don't have facts, right? Even the prosecutor doesn't have a lot of facts. They'll just read the police report and, you know, it's one-sided, obviously, right? And then the judge will say, okay, is there enough evidence or not?
You quote this former Chief Justice Frederick Moore Vinson, who wrote, I think this was in the late 40s or 50s. He wrote this: unless the right to bail is preserved, the presumption of innocence would lose its meaning. So even in the, you know, the mid part of the last century, you had a Chief Justice who was talking about how critical the right to bail is in terms of the connection to the presumption of innocence. And then you look at where we are now.
Right.
I mean, we're really far away from that in some
way. We're really far away from it. And it's a sneaky and perverse thing that happens because in the 1980s, they have to deal with statements like that. There's plenty. There's Coffin. There's an early case in the 1890s that talks about bail and the presumption of innocence being one. Stack also in the 1950s. But then in the 80s, the court is trying to massage the law, you know, not overruling any of that, but trying to deal with it. And they say, well, what the presumption of innocence means is this burden at trial where the prosecutor has to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It no longer has anything to do with this pretrial period. And that's where everything just changes.
But what's going on culturally at the time is this – I'm trying to think of what's going on in the 80s, and it's the Reagan era, right? So a lot of talk, politically anyway, about law and order. Was that influencing this?
Absolutely. So yeah. Huge crime rate raises in the 70s, right? Lots of more violent crime. People are afraid of getting violent crime, getting out of control. The the drug laws are now being passed, right? Their drug rates are increasing, and people are really worried about what's happening in the inner cities in America. And even, I mean, the media really gets a hold of this. That's another big thing that happens, particularly with the drugs. They, you know, overemphasize the importance and the risk of the crack epidemic and all of this. And so kind of, you know, looped into all of this drug reform, those bills, comes in the bail reform, which is another way to kind of protect people, is the thought.
I'm trying to think back on the Willie Horton ad. I'm not sure if you write about that, actually, but there was an ad, a political ad. This was when George Bush is running against Michael Dukakis. And one of the negative ads that the Bush campaign ran was against this Willie Horton, who had committed a crime in between that period. Mm-hmm. Between the time he was arrested and had made bail, mm-hmm. and then he committed a crime.
Right.
It just seems reflective of this kind of hysteria that was going on at the time.
Right. No, absolutely. And I mean, even still, I think there's an issue of that. You know, people don't understand it.
And judges are terrified of letting people go because they may re-offend, right?
Terrified.
But are they? I mean, what are the statistics? Are these people who are released on bail, what do we know about whether or not they are actually dangerous or they are reoffending?
Yeah, good question. So this is something I looked into and with an economist, with Frank McIntyre, because I really did want to figure out how risky are these people and what risk level of risk are we willing to tolerate, right? There's some, you know, we have to be able to tolerate some level of risk because certain people just on the streets today pose a large risk. You think of teenagers, right? As you read my book, you can see, I mean, not that I love teenagers, but they're very risky as far as violent crime,
yeah.
Right? It's, you know, especially under the age of 40, but especially teenagers. But one of the things we looked at is how risky are these individuals that are released on bail? And what we did is looked at violent felons, basically, in the 75 largest counties in the U.S., and we saw what kind of violent crime risk do they pose? And you'd think it was pretty high. At least I did. And when we look at it, you know, 70% of them pose about a 1% risk of a violent crime if released. Really, really low. And, you know, the remainder, you know, pose maybe a 5% risk. And there's maybe, you know, like a quarter of a percent that pose more than like a 10% risk. But they're really low risk if you think about – I mean, this is violent felons. I'm not even talking about people charged with misdemeanors that don't get bail, which is a lot, a big portion. But really,
that's just violent. Okay,
that's just violent felons. And even those that have, you know, four prior convictions for a violent crime and are charged with a violent crime, their risk of committing another violent crime is about 10%, which is high. I mean, we shouldn't be able to tolerate that. They should be detained, I think.
Sure.
But that's just a very, very small percentage. So most people, even those charged with murder, you know, if they don't have a previous conviction record, they're very, very unlikely to commit another violent crime on release.
So you make this argument that basing bail decisions on these predictions of whether, you know, a defendant may commit a crime, first of all, it's not constitutional. But this is where we are. So you mentioned in the book how you can educate judges at least to make better decisions about all of this. Talk a little bit about that, because I think this is interesting. It seems like you're kind of conceding the point. Maybe this is just the way we are, and so let's at least try to make that bail hearing more thoughtful.
Right, and it's funny. It's interesting that you noticed that, because no one else has really critiqued me in that sense, because I have to be a realist, right? My number one argument is it's unconstitutional. We should release everyone on bail. But given our system and where we've come, let's deal with reality. And what reality is we have a system based on prediction. And at least let's do that better. Let's have more information for judges. And it's such a challenge. You wouldn't believe. I mean, I presented this research to judges, and you know, recently it's being a little bit better perceived, I think. But, you know, when I first presented this to the Ninth Circuit judges in, I think it was 2010 or 11, they're kind of like, this is interesting, but we really decide these things on gut instinct. I mean, we have an instinct about these defendants, and that's how we decide. And they were very open about that, which in this day and age with all
but
the data.
But what's a gut instinct based on?
I don't know. I mean, yours is different than mine. So
exactly.
I don't know. I mean, what, you know. So that's the thing is people, and it's kind of a broad issue in criminal justice, but people think they're better at telling who's good or bad or who's lying or not. And it turns out, I mean, all the studies you look at, can police tell who's lying? No, they can't. They actually can't. And often they're worse at it when the defendant's in the same room with them than when they're on the phone or something. So we're just not good at telling who's good, who's bad, who's going to commit a crime, who's not, unless you look at the data. And if they're not willing to do that, you know, there's no way forward.
What do you think about these standardized bail amounts? Like the way they've standardized the system now.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea, this uniform bail schedules. Utah has one.
Yep.
You know, you are charged with a first degree felony, $25,000 is your bail amount. It's unconstitutional. And in fact, there's a group now that in the last 4 or 5 years have challenged this issue. It's equal justice under law. They've challenged it and had this abolished in at least 4 jurisdictions, mostly in the South. That's where they're working with really poor clients. But they've shown that it's, you know, violation of the due process clause because you're not getting an individualized determination, right? It's just you're charged with this felony. There's no individualized determination. They set a high bail, or they don't even consider if you can afford it. That's their other basis for unconstitutionality.
You referred to this earlier, but I wanted to come back to this. One of the things you mentioned in the book is that this kind of throws off the balance in the relationship between a prosecutor and someone who's accused. Because if a person is detained, like if they don't make bail,
right,
they feel more pressure to plead guilty.
Absolutely.
And why? Because they want to just get the hell out of there?
Because jail is miserable.
Yeah.
And you think prison is miserable, but jail is 10 times more miserable, right? That's where people commit suicide. There's disease, the health conditions, it's overcrowded. It's a chaos. It's really, truly a chaotic environment. So people want to get out of there as soon as possible. And so they're just incentivized to get out. And oftentimes the deal, especially with these misdemeanor defendants, they're offered is time served. So why don't you just plead guilty? You've already served 5 days, you're out. And they're just like, duh, of course, no brainer. I mean, I would do that, right? Who wouldn't? You want to spend another 60 days and prove you're innocent in jail? It's awful.
Oh, plus you have a job that
you have
job, to worry about.
You have family often.
Yeah. I suppose the argument is that is the safety concern. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, and I think this is really interesting, is you get at in the book the idea that if this is handled properly, there can actually be a decrease in crime?
Right, absolutely.
Talk about that, because I found that really intriguing.
Right. So the study I did with Frank McIntyre, the economist, we showed that if you release basically the right people based on data, not gut instinct, that you can actually have a 25% reduction in crime. And this is so, you know, this is not looking at race at all, right? Or gender, which are unconstitutional things to look at.
Yeah.
Just looking at age and the type of crime you're charged with and what your previous convictions are. And so basically, you know, how it breaks down is if you've been convicted of 3 or more violent felonies, probably you shouldn't be released, right? I think based on this prediction model. And if you have charges of some kind of, you know, white collar crime, any kind of fraud, those types of things, you're very unlikely to commit a violent crime. So you do get the right to release. And if you're older than 40, you should be able to have the right to release. Very unlikely if you're older to recommit on bail.
So explain the effect of this. I mean, you mentioned mass incarceration, but just give us a sense of the numbers. You say in the book that detention before trial accounts for 99% of the total increase in jail population.
Right. It's huge. I mean, the impact of pretrial detention, this is really the leading cause of what is happening to our jail populations. When we have jail overcrowding, it is purely as a result of pretrial detention. And, you know, if we did solve this, if we were able to have more people released safely, right, doing it the way that we do now with good information to judges, we can reduce crime, right, because some people are released improperly. So when we did this study, one of the interesting things we found in all these counties, the 75 largest counties, is that there's some counties where 90% of people are released and others where only 5% of people are released. And these are similarly situated, right, all charged with the same crimes. And it just depended on the judges, you know, their gut instinct, and there was no consistency between them. And so if we have a kind of more thoughtful, deliberate method of doing this, considering the data, then we can cut these rates down nationwide.
How much is this affecting people of color or just minorities disproportionately? I mean, it must have a disproportionate effect on them.
It absolutely does. And even with the bail rates that if we talk about bail set, so Black and Hispanic individuals are often offered bail amounts that are double the amount as a white person for the same crime. And a really ironic case I talk about in the book, it's just crazy. In Cherry Hill, New Jersey, there's two insurance salesmen. I mean, as equally situated as you can imagine, right? One black, one white. They're both charged with a DUI. Go to the same judge, and one of them is offered a $300 bail, and he's able to be released. The other is offered a $500 bail, but he can't sign for his own bail, which is a huge thing on a weekend. He ends up spending 3 days in jail because he has to have, you know, someone else sign for it, whereas the white guy is allowed to. And the judge even comments kind of like, you know, this guy might be dangerous, whereas the guy that's white looks like him. It's kind of less perceived. And this kind of thing happens all over the country in every courtroom where the judge might see someone and say, well, yeah, that could have been me. You know, he was at a party, he had one too many drinks, and then ended up in court.
Well, this gets back to what you mentioned, judges relying on their gut instinct to decide who to release. And,
right.
And sometimes, let's be honest, maybe a sort of prejudice, a kind of a cultural bias can sneak into the system. If you don't have anything built in to keep you from that, then you're just stuck with it, I guess.
That's right. And really, we're so bad at figuring out what our implicit biases are. I mean, we don't know them. That's why it's so important. We have these double-blind studies, right? Now we have doctors that are double-blinded so that they don't know which patients are receiving certain doses of medicine so that they're not biased, because we have this implicit bias, all of us. It doesn't make us bad as humans, but we have this. And in the law, in the criminal justice system, we really haven't accounted for this at all. We don't have judges that are double-blinded to the defendant's race or prosecutors. I mean, this is something else I've written about that I think is important to do. But that bias, like you say, is so important.
Sheema Bharadaran Bhoffman is the author of the book, The Bail Book, A Comprehensive Look at Bail in America's Criminal Justice System. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the legal scholar Sheema Bharadaran Bhoffman. We're talking about her book, The Bail Book, A Comprehensive Look at Bail in America's Criminal Justice System. What's the reaction you're getting from, I'm not sure if you've had a chance to really present to, you mentioned presenting to judges, but what about lawmakers and others? Are people interested in reforming the system? Because it's going to take quite an effort to reform it, it seems.
Absolutely. And even before this book, you know, I've been writing articles about this for about 8 years, and lawmakers consistently have reached out to me. So New Jersey had a big bail reform effort, Colorado, you know, lots of states are considering this. Utah, for instance, is another state that's considering this. And they do reach out at every step and kind of, you know, consider the evidence. And that's really what is changing, is people are all of a sudden looking at this data now that it's out there, right? We didn't have this for a long time, but now that we're seeing how the jail population is becoming so overbloated and that bail is a large contributor, I think a lot of people are saying, let's figure this out. And you know, surprisingly, with the states that have done this, it is pretty low-hanging fruit. It's not that hard to fix. It's one of those, you know, easier things to fix in the system, except for one big major problem, which is the bail bond industry. And I don't know if you wanted to get into that.
Let's do. Because now you've got an industry, I'm not sure how many millions or billions are involved in this industry in the nationwide, but it must be pretty large. Do we have a sense of that, and how powerful a lobbying industry is it? And clearly they're going to be pushing back on some of these reform efforts.
Absolutely. Bail and more importantly, the bail insurance industry is a $14 billion industry in the U.S. It is a huge moneymaker. And so anytime there's any talk of reforming bail, you know, the bail advocates, particularly the American Bail Coalition, which is the kind of lobbying arm of the bail industry, will get up in arms and upset. And they're always, you know, meeting with legislators, trying to lobby. And really, you know, as we talked about earlier, so from the 1990s to, say, 2009, the amount of people on bail went from 53% to about 70% that are using commercial bail.
Wow.
And so and that's really when they started lobbying. So if you look at the evidence of when they started a kind of grassroots nationwide campaign with sheriff's departments, with prosecutors, and in some, you know, giving donations to those that are running for office and that type of thing. And this real grassroots lobbying effort has been massively successful, to so that the bail is now, you know, 70% of individuals are relying on commercial bail, where it used to be that there was other options. So you could put up your house, you could put up your car. And now it's like courts are like, this is easier. And also, you know, because of lobbying efforts, it's become the primary way to get out of jail.
So if the idea of predicting for whether or not someone will commit a crime is just the way these decisions are going to be made, which it sounds like they are for now, you're kind of conceding that point. Are there good systems? One of the things you write about is this random forest modeling. Which I guess is kind of like an algorithm where you plug in these various factors.
Right. There's a lot of different. So, you know, they're under a broad umbrella of what they call pretrial assessment tools, pretrial risk assessments. And basically what you do is you just get as much information. And I think you need to be careful about what information you collect. I can talk about that. But you get a bunch of information and put it into an algorithm, basically, and figure out who's most likely to be committing a violent crime and who's dangerous and who's not.
But do you like these?
Well, I mean, again, it's better than gut instinct, right?
Yes,
Let's go there.
Yeah.
It's way better than judges deciding based on, you know, their gut what's right, because these are more effective and they are going to be more likely to say, let's detain the people that are dangerous and release those that are safe to release.
New Jersey, you mentioned Kentucky.
Kentucky.
And I think there are a few states that you think are decent models for the rest of the country.
Sure, yeah. I mean, D.C. is kind of the hallmark. They have put a lot of time and consideration into creating a pretrial release system where most people are released. So 90% are released and 90% appear for trial, which is amazing. And Kentucky, similar. About 90% are released. And 90% appear for their court dates and are not rearrested. That's way better than any of the numbers you have nationwide as far as people out on bail or anything else. And so, you know, Kentucky is one of four states that's actually banned a money bail, commercial money bail. So Oregon, Kentucky, Illinois, they've all banned it. And it's, you know, they've seen some really great results. So they've become a model for the rest of the country to say, look, we can do this. We can do it without commercial bail.
How far off would Utah be if you're doing something like that? Do you have a sense yet?
I don't. I mean, we have pretrial release in Salt Lake City, and other counties are working on it. And there's some opposition here with lobbying efforts of the bail industry. But I think the lawmakers are really on board. The judicial system definitely is. They just did an audit this past year and published, and that they said, you know, we need to kind of work towards some kind of risk assessment model rather than having judges blindly, having no information at all, make decisions on bail. We need more information at least. And they've also said, you know, we need to work towards eliminating money bail. So they want it. It's just, you know, can the lawmakers overcome the interests of the lobby?
So is there any going back to where we used to be? I mean, at least they're thinking about eliminating money bail. Right.
No, they're thinking about it. And I think they're realizing with the overcrowding of the jail, which is another issue that people are having, that this is going hand in hand, right? You have to put a little bit of upfront cost into paying for a pretrial release system because it does cost some money at the outset. But in the long run, it does lead to lower costs. And I mean, you think of all the states that have done this. So Iowa is another early state that worked on pretrial reform. And they showed, look, it costs us, you know, $4,000 a year to monitor somebody that's released pretrial, or $20,000 a year to keep them in jail. And in New York City, it's $40,000 a year. So it's a lot more expensive to keep people in jail than to release them and supervise them.
I want to ask you about what you call optimal bail. Let's compare bail reform to optimal bail, because there's a difference here. Explain this.
Sure. Optimal bail is just what I call kind of an ideal system given our current realities. And most of it is
not where you want it, but given where we are, let's at least fix it.
That's right. Let's at least fix it. Yeah. And it's based on three principles that you can kind of apply. But one is, you know, let's only restrain people's liberty, so keep them locked up, as it's necessary to protect public safety. And that really, how do you determine that? You do a pretrial risk assessment.
Right.
And that, I think, should be focused not on you know, some of them are focused on, do they own a house? Do they own property? Do they have, I mean, it shouldn't be based on money, right? How much money you have and whether you're fortunate enough to have bought a house at that point. Mm. It should be based on, you know, what's your current charge? Have you had previous arrests or convictions? And, you know, that kind of thing.
Another one of those principles is there should be no pretrial determination of guilt.
That's right. No weighing of evidence, no pretrial determination of guilt. That should be for the jury. So all the states, there's about 20 states that have this pretrial weighing, you know, they should eliminate that. They shouldn't have this weighing of evidence. And also, it shouldn't be done without counsel. So the Supreme Court has said that the bail hearing is an ultimate place where you need counsel. It's a very determinative hearing. It's a very impactful hearing for a defendant. But how many states have bail counsel at hearings? Most don't. So more than half of people appear in court don't have bail hearings. So that's another critical piece.
And then I think the other one you mentioned is their release shouldn't be contingent on wealth or their ability to pay.
Right.
So if they don't have money to make bail, what do you do?
So if they don't have money to make bail, like in states that don't have money bail, they are released and supervised with a pretrial release service. And so the state will supervise them. They give them calls. They make them appear in court. And so they, you know, keep track of them that way.
What percentage of would fall into that category? Do you have an idea of that? I'm just trying to assess what the threat is to the bail bond industry, because that's the threat.
It is a threat, and a large percentage, right? Yeah. A large percentage would be able to be safely supervised and released. And that is the threat to the bail bond industry. But at the same time, I mean, I think when people are concerned about pretrial crime and then they say, well, let's keep the bail bonds industry in, I guess, in play, it's hard because when the bail bond industry is the one that's in charge of releasing individuals, right, they don't actually supervise them. Mm-hmm. And their incentive isn't to make them not recommit crimes, right? So when a bail bondsman is supervising you, if you get rearrested, what happens? They just gain another client. You have to pay the fee again to get released. It's like a repeat client. Whereas if you have pretrial services supervising somebody, their incentive is to get you to not be rearrested and to appear at court, or else they're not doing their job effectively. And I mean, I've actually talked to the bail bonds industry and I've said to them, I said, look, I can get on board with what you're doing. Maybe if you could actually supervise individuals, make sure they're not being, you're not really providing a service to the public. You're just getting a fee. If they get rearrested, you don't care. And their numbers look pretty bad on that, right? They do often get rearrested and they do commit crimes. So it's not like,
what did they say? That's an interesting
idea.
He
said, well, no. And this was the former president.
I mean, that
president.
Makes a lot of sense.
It does make a lot of sense. I know. I'm like, if you're providing
you're
a
so
service,
smart.
Well, it's kind of, I mean, I'm not against market solutions to criminal justice or anything.
Yeah.
So I'm like, if we could make it work, but there's not a way to make it work fairly. And they're not interested in supervising like pretrial services, because I could see a public-private model, right? Where, you know, there's a state model, the pretrial release services, and then there's a private one where they do the same thing. And you could choose, you know, the state could choose and then see what works better. But they're not interested in doing the work of pretrial services. They just want to get the fee. And so it's just the current model is just not going to work.
You write early in the book that the decision of whether to release a person on bail has consequences for an individual. We were talking about that before. But you say also for society. What's the effect on society, do you think, of all of this?
Yeah, I think all of us, I mean, we talked about this earlier, but this idea that we don't have this, you know, presumption of innocence anymore, that people don't have this. You see someone arrested, you see someone charged with something, you assume their guilt. And so it's really had a cultural impact on all of us that when someone is arrested, we assume they're guilty. In fact, when you apply for a lot of jobs now, what do they ask you? Have you been arrested? Have you been convicted? And again, it's a complete cultural shift from what it used to be, that you're arrested or charged with something, you have this right to be presumed innocent until they prove it that you're not. And I mean, there's a little bit of a you know, backlash to that with the wrongful conviction movement, where people are realizing lots of people have actually confessed to crimes and are wrongfully convicted. But there's this cultural shift on society that has been that, look, we presume that people are guilty all the time. And also the cost that we bear because of that, right? Society has to pay these costs. There's, you know, $78 billion are some of the estimates of costs that just for pretrial detention. You know, $14 billion a year is what the current estimate is on what we're paying for pretrial detention alone. And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money that could go to education and other amazing things.
I'll come back to something that we had referred to earlier, finally. You write this in your book. You say, in just a few short years, the U.S. has gone from releasing 56% of defendants to only 40% without any complaint or even acknowledgement by scholars or policy advocates. You think that's shifting, it sounds like. You sound optimistic that people are starting to pay attention to this.
They are, and they definitely are. I mean, Jay-Z, if you see the first quote in my book, is Jay-Z has written something last year, and John Oliver's talked about it. I mean, there's a lot of national movement on this. The football players recently took a knee. I forget what team. I'm not a football fan. But they took a knee because they thought, you know, this is injustice for bail. There's all these community groups forming bail funds. And some of them are specifically, let's get black people out on bail because of the injustices that blacks face, and other Black Lives Matter is involved. So there's a lot of people saying this is an injustice and we need to be part of this. And this is not how it was when I first started writing about bail in 2010. It's really, the momentum has just shifted completely.
Shima Bharatharan Boffman is a professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. Her book is The Bail Book, A Comprehensive Look at Bail in America's Criminal Justice System. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Claire Jones. We have technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.